Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by OneCause, the creator of user-friendly fundraising software that helps nonprofits engage donors, raise more money, and save valuable time and resources. At OneCause, we know that auction fundraising is an effective way to spread your mission and reach goals, but requires expert planning. To rock your next auction, we've released a step-by-step guide, the Auction Survival Kit. It includes best practices to power your fundraising, engage attendees, and raise more money at your next event. Filled with information for the novice to the experienced fundraiser, download the Auction Event Survival Kit at www.onecause.com/responsive30. That's www.onecause.com/responsive30. Hi, Travis. Welcome back to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. You and I talked several months ago about a big provocative question of whether or not fundraising professionals should be paid commissions. And you and I, before we hit the record button, we're just sort of debriefing on some of the feedback we got. So let's have another conversation today and see if we can get some more feedback. Before we start that conversation, Travis, why don't you just introduce yourself briefly to our listeners?
Absolutely. Jason, thank you again for having me on and having me back on to the program today. So I'm Travis McDearman. I am the lead development officer for Butler University's Jordan College of the Arts and Butler Art Center. I am also an adjunct faculty member for Indiana University Lilly Family School of Philanthropy. And I'm a 12-year fundraising, I'm not going to really say veteran at this point, but I've been able to go across most of the spectrum, major gifts, annual gifts, research, and just about everything in between. So, again, I appreciate you having me back on the show, and I look forward to continuing our discussion from the last time.
Yeah. So, Travis, I remember last time we talked to you, you shared with me and that your wife is a fundraiser as well.
She is.
I do remember that. Yeah. So what's been her thoughts about on the previous conversation, the notion of paying major gifts officers, for instance, commissions? What's her thoughts on that?
Completely disagrees.
Ah.
But we also have a household where I went to the University of Kentucky and she went to Indiana. So rivalry is not new, you know. No, but she listens to the arguments as I put them out. And she actually was very helpful when I was formulating what I was going to discuss, the points that may be more relevant. So she's been very helpful, not only in my career, but also in some of the radical things that I do put out there.
Yeah. So what are you thinking about today? What's the big idea that we can spend 25 minutes or so talking about?
So I'm going to stay on the same genre. As you said, for last time we talked about what if we were to start paying gift officers for paying commission for the work that they do for organizations. And we kind of talked about the ethical considerations, donor trust. So staying on that same idea or same genre, at least, I'm going to talk about a few more for-profit practices that development offices could implement to possibly help move the needle forward, but may just have not been thought about yet. And kind of in line with the idea of like how we're doing donor discovery for major donors and then how we're doing market research. So kind of staying on that same path, but just going in a different area. And kind of like the last time, I'm focusing really on alarming trend. For the last conversation, it was the loss of gift officers that organizations see all the time. Since that conversation, I've actually read an article that was put out. I think it was somewhere around 30% are looking to leave in the next year. I mean, that was kind of a very alarming trend. But for this conversation, the kind of trend that I'm looking at is, you know, we are in now at that point where we are raising more money every year, Giving USA, VSE, all these different outlets are showing that we are bringing in more charitable dollars every year, but we're doing it with less donors.
Right.
And we're also doing it with less major donors. Our principal gifts are getting bigger. You know, the billion-dollar gifts are getting bigger, but the $25, $50, $100,000 gifts are actually getting smaller. So that, again, is an alarming trend, because any economist will tell you that's unsustainable. Eventually, there's going to be a level off. So we're either going to do a knee-jerk reaction when that level off happens and try to solve the problem then, or we can get ahead of it now, which is where I'm wanting to go with this conversation.
Okay. Well, you know the routine, so keep us going.
Sure. So as you know, I am a storyteller. So I'll kind of put the context of why this, or how this came about and why I decided to use it for this particular conversation. So a few years ago, I was considering a career change, getting out of fundraising completely. Here in central Indiana, like a lot of cities, we have a growing tech industry. So I started exploring, are there opportunities for me within, you know, those companies that have popped up here recently? So I spoke to several people that I knew in my network who worked in the tech industry. I actually spoke to a few recruiters as well. And what was pointed out was my transferable skills from fundraising would be best utilized in sales. One recruiter in particular, actually a company that I was actually looking at pretty seriously, was pushing me to what's called inside sales. So inside sales is pretty much an entry-level sales job in any kind of business-to-business type of opportunity. But what you do is you work with existing clients, so those who have already bought the product.
Okay.
You maintain that positive customer experience. You help them with any issues they have, then, and you direct them where they need to go. And then, of course, you upsell when possible, when there is another solution within your company that can help them do their job better. So the benefits for inside sales is you are able from the very first day to start learning the company and the products just forward and backward. You're also able to get comfortable in talking with clients without really the pressure of making a sale because they've already bought on. And then you're able to learn even more about how the products are being utilized and then how you can find better solutions for them and then for future clients by upselling and working with the engineers and making sure that customer sales experience and what they're getting out of your company is working for their particular industry. Once you prove yourself, then you're able to move into more direct sales. So you're starting to bring in new clients.
Right.
So if you put this in the context, if you take it out of the for-profit model and put it in the non-profit model, essentially they're hiring brand new people to do stewardship from the very get-go. They're taking the existing people who are already signed on, working with them intimately, making sure that they're happy, and then hopefully getting, you know, the next gift out of them, you know, or, you know, working towards that next gift.
Right.
So when you put this in so if you go back to fundraising and how we do it in nonprofits, we do it completely opposite, almost exactly opposite. Our model is for donor discovery, especially with major gifts, is to bring in new gift officers, have them do discovery, have them introduced the potential donors to the idea of giving, and then help them close that way. The stewardship for those who have already given, whether at a major level or principal level, is done by the gift officer who was already there before, or the more senior gift officer who may already be in the organization or who may be brought on later on. And again, this is kind of, I mean, it's a practice that's worked for us for a long time, and there's really not necessarily anything wrong with that practice, but is it the best way to be going about doing donor discovery, knowing that major donors are actually falling off just like our annual donors are? And at some point, again, we're going to have to figure out a solution. How do we do better discovery? How do we continue to fill our pipelines for major donors? I can pick on higher ed because I've worked in higher ed for a long time. We are notorious for this practice. Two institutions I've actually worked for were facing, even leading up into their campaigns, were facing major gift donor deficits, and went out and hired just platoons full of gift officers
right.
to come in and do discovery. That was their entire job, was to go out and do discovery. I don't want to throw anybody under the bus, but the results were a little mixed. So take a logical breakdown of this practice here, and I'll show you why maybe it's a little bit backwards, and why it may even be a little bit detrimental to what we're wanting to do. So you take a brand new gift officer, someone who may have some development experience. You know, they may have been in annual giving or stewardship, or
right.
May have worked in the telephone, but they've never worked one-on-one with a donor. On the other side of the equation, you have a brand new major gift prospect. You know, someone who may have been giving annually, but again, has also never worked one-on-one with a gift officer in order to work philanthropy that way. You're not exactly stacking the deck here, you know, when you're putting the most inexperienced gift officer with the most inexperienced donor. But yet we are expecting the magic to happen. And again, plenty of times it does happen, so that's great. If we were to change to a more for-profit model, could we take an inexperienced gift officer, place them with an experienced donor, and help them build their skills that way while working with that donor, get them in the proper stewardship that they deserve, and then, you know, hopefully leading them to the next gift that they're going to do for your organization? And then may you take the experienced gift officers, those who are very comfortable working with donors of all genres, and then put them in place with the inexperienced donors. That way you're not having to constantly relearn I'll get back with you kind of question. You already know, you know, what's going to happen or what's needed by the organization a little bit better. It's kind of just the laws of physics, you know, that the polar opposites attract in that way. You know, we can use that to advantage. Go ahead.
Okay. So I had never thought about it this way, Travis, but when I'm routinely talking to audiences, I say to them, I've just never sort of squared it up this way, but I suggest to them that if you find a inexperienced or non-experienced, completely inexperienced, brand new development officer, and hand him or her a list of 125 names of current donors and tell her that all she can do is dial the phone and say thank you for the last gift and ask a series of questions. And I often say that person will raise more money.
Mm-hmm.
And that's essentially what you're saying. But it kind of makes me wonder. I've never sort of processed my own advice a whole lot with a whole lot of depth. And yet it's lining up sort of perfectly with what you're suggesting. But I'm also reminded of a story. So I was spending some time with a woman who really wanted to get into major gift work. 3 or 4 years ago, and she was interviewing for a job at a very large Ivy League institution here on the Eastern Seaboard. And she had no experience. And I said to her, you know, without 20 years experience in major gifts, they're not going to put you in any of those roles you're interviewing for. But I told her, I said, you know, I could teach you at the local, you know, Humane Society how to do a lot of the work that they need you to do. I could teach you how to do it in about 6 months and you'd be a rock star. And that's kind of what you're getting at is that that the donor themselves, the most experienced donor, the most engaged, the donor who's the most in love with the organization is also going to be the donor who's going to instill that everything you could possibly want that brand new, fresh out the gate major gift officer to know, that donor will teach them.
Absolutely. I mean, look at the benefits for all three parties involved: the new gift officer, the seasoned gift officer, and of course the donor. You know, the benefits for the new gift officer is they learn the organization, whether it's the Ivy League school or whether it's the Humane Society. By saying thank you, by hearing the stories, by meeting with them, again, without that pressure to close that first gift, you know, or meet that goal in the first year, you know, they're really going to absorb how to do this job, how to work with donors, the difference between, you know, working with a donor one-on-one versus doing it on the telephone. They're also going to learn multiple avenues of giving because of the whole barrage of opportunities they'd be able to steward. You know, they'd be stewarding major gift donors who are doing cash, but some of them may be doing CGAs. Some of them may be doing bequest. So they'll get to learn that way as well by talking to the individuals. Plus, there is the benefit for a new gift officer. Well, you know, it's pretty common knowledge that the next major gift usually comes from the person who made a prior major gift. So they probably are most likely going to close major gifts quicker, which may reduce that burnout. That was the big issue that I saw in those institutions I worked, where those gift officers whose entire job was to do discovery and then pass off donors, they were burning out very quickly. And they were also, it was hurting their professional development later on. Well, I had discovered all these great donors, but I never closed anything. You know, that's moving them to the next level. You know, we want to see results. You know, that's kind of how our industry is.
See, Travis, I don't think you're talking about sales. I just think you're talking about, and I remember this from our previous conversation. I remember the idea that we're just at a place as a profession that we need to start thinking through our processes. And think about, and you're using the sales industry as sort of a way to sort of, as a lens, if you will. I don't think you're so much taking on sales, great, brilliant sales insight here. I think you're just sort of taking a critical look at the process with which we pair up these different, we create these different scenarios and saying, okay, which one's going to work out the most, which one's going to create the most advantages for all the parties involved? And I don't know that the profession has ever given it much thought that the gift officer who were oftentimes paying the most amount of money, who's, you know, the most experienced gift officer, who therefore is supposedly entitled to the largest compensation, is also generally working with the major donor who's been around the longest and is most likely to renew. And that's some of the easiest work you can do.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. And I know that's where the torches and the pitchforks are going to come after me when I say this kind of stuff. You know, for the seasoned gift officers, yeah, I mean, if you take that job where you're handed that portfolio of 100 people who have already committed, who are already on, they're board members, sign me up, Jason, put me in that position now and let me ride it out. But I do think there are some benefits in this model for the seasoned gift officers as well. I mean, we still, you know, even at the top level, you still have a lot of turnover. And some of that comes from just kind of just becoming stale, you know, working on the same projects with the same people, losing that competitive edge that drives a lot of us into this profession in the first place, you know, allowing them to be mentors to the new gift officers. You know, in that way, with the transition relationship, you know, you're not removing them completely from the situation. That would be disastrous if you did that. You're also allowing them to continue to expand their professional networks as they work with more new donors and bring them into the camp as well.
Travis, I don't think they want to. I honestly don't have a whole lot to lose. I focus most of my time and resources on younger, new, aspiring fundraising talent. So I'm not gonna hurt anybody's feelings that I'm terribly overly concerned with, but I don't think those highly experienced major gift officers want to do it this way because I think they're lazy. I think what we're zeroing in on is, and you know what the flip side of this is going to be, is that highly experienced major gift officer is going to reach out to you or me, and they're going to say to us, yeah, but the relationship, is so critically important, and I'm the one who's cultivated this relationship, but therein comes the sort of the even more fundamental problem with all this that we have to wrestle with. And it's who owns the relationship. Why doesn't the institution own that relationship? Or why is it sort of resting solely with one individual? And I think it comes down to, you've got a 20-year veteran in there who knows that he or she can secure extraordinary gifts without putting a whole lot of effort in, because he or she knows that that's kind of the way this works.
Exactly. But yeah, we also have to think about what's the benefit for the donor as well. So, you know, current donors, one of the best things about this job, and especially when it comes to stewardship, and you and I work this all the time, you know, we ask donors or potential donors for advice. Yeah. And it's not because we're just trying to get donors. We actually do want advice from them. You know, if I'm going to start working with performing arts donors in the Washington, D.C. area, I don't know that, you know, that population at all. I need to go to these people and get their insights and use it so we can, again, continue to move the needle forward. So the benefit to the donor is being able to provide that mentorship along with the philanthropy, what they're doing and what they're trying to accomplish with the institution. And it hits exactly what you said. It also allows us to have people with multiple touch points with one potential donor.
Right.
I don't know what the, I mean, I actually haven't, I've heard it in conversation. I've never actually seen it in writing, but the general understanding is that for a principal gift, for someone to make that transformational gift, they have to have 12 relationships within an institution. That's just kind of the number I've heard. I don't really have any to back that up.
That's a heck of a lot more than one.
That's exactly.
When you're sitting there speaking to that very sometimes arrogant major gift officer who thinks that he or she is sort of the be all end all to that, you know, extraordinary transformational gift, he's only one of 12.
Right. And I would challenge a little bit on the laziness sides of things, because I think it's, there could be that definitely a part of it. I think it's also because the metrics themselves that we set for our gift officers do not align with doing discovery the farther you go up the chain. You know, if you're a seasoned gift officer, your metrics are to continue to work with those people who are already seasoned. You know, and that's how the system is set up. If your metrics are changed and 25% of your portfolio needs to be discovery, that changes everything. You know, how you do your job.
Okay, so you're borrowing that word discovery from the sales world, and I don't know. Essentially, what you're getting at is you're getting at the idea that we need to employ major gift officers in particular, because we're kind of in the major gift officer box here. We need to employ them to upgrade the donor, or it's the net gain that is sort of happening from year to year, more than we need to compensate them for the renewal of the money that they already essentially raised last year and can pretty much count on.
Yeah, exactly.
Interestingly, this gets back to our previous conversation in that, how do we compensate them? I suspect that when it comes to compensation arrangements for salespeople that involve commissions, oftentimes it's probably structured around, and I think of the first sales job that I had coming out of college, there were particular points along the sales process where I made better margins or better commissions on whatever it is I sold. And so whereas $1 raised means X, another dollar raised could have meant, you know, X times,
right,
you know,
right,
you know, 1.2 or something. So it was a different rate of commission. Gosh, we're going to get in a lot of trouble for this, Travis, but, I'm not the pro sales guy, but you've definitely got me thinking here.
Yeah. And I believe it or not, I've actually seen this work before. And it was completely by accident. I want to say that, you know, myself and everyone I've ever worked with are all just fundraising geniuses. And, you know, everybody needs to hire us all the time. But so I went to work for an organization who had hired probably a couple of years before. They had hired a brand new, I mean, probably just 2 years out of college, to do some alumni programming. So the programming was to work with the major donors, but it was to provide mentorship opportunities for undergraduate students. So it was a very, you know, interesting program. And he did a very good job at it. But it allowed him to build these deep relationships with some of our best donors and board members and people who have been involved for a long time for when we actually transitioned to a gift officer position. He was already primed and ready to start making asks. He was already primed and ready to go out and start doing discovery and working with donors of every level because of that experience he had had in working with donors in another way. And that was just, I mean, that's the kind of the only opportunity I've actually seen this happen. Again, it was by accident, but it really worked out, and he was very successful. And then when we lost him, I mean, he was with us for 5 years. It was definitely a good tenure. When we lost him, we lost a lot of good relationships because of what he's been able to build when he was doing the programming along with when he was doing as a gift officer as well. So, yeah, it's just a different way of looking about how we're doing metrics for our new gift officers, our seasoned, how we are bringing people into the fold, yeah, how we are compensating and holding people accountable for what they're doing. It's just kind of that, you know, I always love that messy adolescence thing that you talk about, because just one of those ideas of, okay, we have this tradition of doing it a certain way.
We do.
And tradition is great sometimes, but also tradition can kill things as well. And right now, if you look at the data with the major donors who we're losing, if we keep on the traditional model, we're going to continue to lose. So we have to change it somehow. We have to try something.
So I'll share another story and get your feedback on this, and then we'll wrap up. So four years ago, I was interviewing a woman who was working in higher education in what I will describe as sort of a glorified administrative assistant role. Essentially her job, I was trying to move her into what you and I would sort of describe as an entry level major gifts role, at a small private school that I was, doing a search for. But I got a sense while interviewing her that she could do this and that she would fit the bill really well. Excuse me. But she was in this glorified administrative assistant role at this large higher ed institution in Texas. And what I figured out, Travis, is that she was scheduling meetings for three major gifts officers who were hopping on airplanes and going around the country and collecting checks. And what I also figured out is that she was building meaningful relationships with these people at the same time. And I thought, you know, you're doing the heavy lifting, getting these people on the phone, getting them scheduled, and then you're letting these guys, you know, these charming guys get on the airplanes and travel around the country and collect on checks that they collected on last year. And my bet, you know, and again, I don't have any verifiable data on this, but my bet is that she was making at least probably half what those fellows were making. And I think that's, again, getting to the messiness of what it is you're sort of zeroing in on is what is it we're actually compensating people to do, and what is the hard work, and what is it that would actually keep people in these jobs? If we take these new, younger, aspiring fundraisers and put them in front of highly enthusiastic major donors, you might keep these people around a little longer. I think there's plenty of major donors who get tired of seeing a guy like me show up every year and asking for the same six-figure gift. Right? Am I right?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, I've working with donors, they do enjoy the opportunity to mentor anyone, whether it's a student, whether it's me, whether it's, you know, whatever organization you're a part of, they like to be involved in that way. So we can keep them involved and also set up these new gift officers to keep them around for more than 16 to 18 months. You know, let's try it. let's just give it a shot and see if it works.
I don't think it's going to be higher education, big D1 schools, for example. I don't think they're the ones who are going to experiment with this, but I do think that there are institutions that can experiment with these sorts of ideas. I'm thinking of a client that I'm currently doing a search for in Philadelphia, a very small institution. First time they're going to hire a major gifts officer. It strikes me that they could sort of take the insights that you and I are sort of simmering on here, apply it to that job, prove its validity, and then sort of let it sort of simmer to the top through the, through the industry and make changes. You know, there's plenty of other institutions in a city like Philadelphia that could even, they could eventually sort of pay attention and find out that other ways of doing things might work. Travis, I've had you for more than a half hour. If somebody's listening to us and they want to banter back with you and tell you, you know, you don't know what the hell you're talking about, what would be the best way for them to reach out and do that?
There's a couple ways that you can reach me. One is through LinkedIn. Just search Travis McDearman and I'll come up, and I'm always happy to have conversations over LinkedIn. You can find my email address through our through Butler University's advancement website. I'm listed on there as well. And I also have a blog that I write and post in LinkedIn pretty regularly, roleidentity.com. Feel free to read and to subscribe and, you know, make some comments on there as well. Because I have articles that actually talk about this, you know, actual, this particular topic, and would love to hear some feedback.
Thank you, Travis. It's always a pleasure. To my, to our listening audience, Travis, this has been our second conversation. If you're interested in being on the podcast, having conversations of this sort, we'd love to hear from you.
Thanks, Jake.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.